Today's episode is sponsored by the John A. Hartford Foundation. For more than three decades, the John A. Hartford Foundation has worked to improve the care of older adults. The foundation is your central resource for developing policy around cost-effective, age-friendly health systems. Learn more at johnahartford.org.
If I make a mistake on the blog, it's really easy for me to say mea culpa, fix it, and own it. I do get worried more that if I make a mistake in the New York Times, that that's their reputation.
I'm Dan Diamond. This is Pulse Check, and that was Aaron Carroll talking about his path from little-known blogger to the front page of the New York Times. I've known Aaron for years, and I've seen so many people in healthcare ask him this question: how can I do what you do? So in this podcast, we discussed Aaron's career as a doctor turned writer and what he gets to see from his perch in the Midwest that those of us who live on the coast end up missing. We also talked a bit about Aaron's new book, The Bad Food Bible, which gets into food myths, and discussed Aaron's writing partner, Austin Fracht, who appeared on an episode of Pulse Check back in April. You can find links in the show notes. Just a heads up, I recorded this conversation with Aaron a few weeks ago. You might catch a few dated references. And we also have a few other podcasts that are waiting for their debut, including a conversation with Atul Gawande. So stay tuned for that. And now here's my conversation with Aaron. And this was a fun chat to do. You're a doctor, you're a writer, you're a YouTube video star. What is the thing that you are most excited about in your portfolio of roles and activities?
Probably the writing or the YouTube. I mean, at its heart, what I'm trying to do is improve people's understanding about science and research and how we can use that to make decisions in our lives, specifically with health. But, you know, you want the biggest audience possible, and there's no doubt in my mind it's the stuff I do that's facing the lay public that is much more impactful and much more important than the peer-reviewed literature or the things that I do as part of my real job.
So what's one example of a YouTube video that you've done that you feel like took a big abstract issue and made it real for the lay public?
God, that's a great question. I mean, there are a lot of them that I love. I'm real passionate about. We just did a four-part series on firearms. And I feel like that's a topic that, you know, if you write about, it becomes such a touch point. And granted, with what just happened recently in Nevada, it's even harder to do. But we were able to sort of break it down and talk about, you know, what is the history of guns in America? And then we talked about how do guns relate to homicide, how do guns relate to suicide, and then to look at the evidence and the research about what policy has made an impact. And to be able to get to do that and try to distill a ton of research and literature in ways that I hope will resonate with people and that they can view in, you know, 6 to 10 minute videos, that's something I would never get to do in my regular professor of pediatrics job. We did a great series a couple years ago, which tried to look at different healthcare systems to try to explain what different countries had. I mean, this was way back when we started the show in like 2014. And we just recently did a piece in the New York Times, which mirrored that and brought it to a whole
lot. The Tournament of Nations.
Yes.
It was a brilliant concept. I'm very jealous that we didn't have that idea first.
It's funny because I was so pleased to see that it resonated as well as it did, but, you know, I felt like we also did that in healthcare triage, and, you know, you reach a different audience each time you do it. But those are another group of videos that I'm super proud of that we've done.
I think what you're hitting on, though, is that so many of these issues are evergreen. The issue of which healthcare system is the best, the issue of how do we fix gun violence. I mean, you can kind of go down the list, and the problems in healthcare and public health are persistent. So have you seen your work in one of these mediums and in one of these places, have you seen it lead to practical systemic change?
So we don't have randomized controlled trials in my work to prove that there's causality. But I do like to think that some of the things we've done have maybe shifted the needle. And it's funny, too, because you say some of this stuff is evergreen. Like a year ago, I wrote about high school start times, focusing on some of the research showing that they're not healthy, that making high school kids get up so early for school has health impacts. And then just about a month ago, I wrote about the economic impacts, which for me was like, well, this is different, but it was, and it was as if I'd never written about it before. These things are evergreen. And the response that I got to that was much larger than I expected. And granted, part of that is because of where they put it on the homepage or if they put it in print, but I got more feedback about that than almost any other of my recent pieces. And if, and a lot of it was, hey, you know, I read that last one you did and, you know, we went to our school board and we got the time shifted. Now, I'll never believe that it was my article that caused that to happen, but I did get a lot of feedback and emails and comments saying, we brought this to our school board or we've been discussing this and we're hoping to see change. And in that respect, it does feel like you're making an impact in some way.
Well, the impact that you can make is significant between some of these platforms. And the New York Times is the paper of record. You're writing there frequently. The Green Brothers and their YouTube empire, you are the resident medical health expert. How big is that network, just for listeners who might not be as familiar with Hank Green, yeah. John Green?
I mean, John's book comes out today, and it's God
we're recording
knows.
This on Tuesday, October
yes.
10th.
Yeah. I mean, how many gazillions of copies is he going to sell? But it's
this is The Fault in Our Stars author.
He wrote The Fault in Our Stars. He wrote the book that just came out as Turtles All the Way Down. Not that he needs me to promote it in any way, but
this is the nudge that will get it on the New York Times bestseller.
There you go.
Because
as if it weren't there, just in pre-sales. But John and Hank are like almost the godfathers of YouTube. I mean, they still run sort of VidCon, which is like the YouTube conference. They were some of the original people more than 10 years ago who started doing vlogging.
Video blogging,
and they had a conversation with each other. And Healthcare Triage got its start because John did an episode of Vlogbrothers, which is their sort of conversation up and back, which was on why does healthcare cost so much in the United States. And he cited our blog, The Incidental Economist, heavily, and specifically a 10-part series I'd written on why does healthcare cost so much in the United States. And it is still, I think, one of the top five most viewed episodes they've ever had. I mean, it had millions of views. It was really viral. And I didn't know at the time, I think neither did he, that we both lived in Indianapolis. And so he emailed me, someone connected us on Twitter, and he emailed me and said, buy a cup of coffee. And I said, yes. And he's like, we want to do the show. So John and Hank, Crash Course, if you have a high schooler, is shown in like almost every high school across the country. They make Crash Course. They make SciShow. They make, besides Healthcare Triage, which has, I mean, I'm embarrassed to say like 250,000 subscribers. They make Sexplanations. There's a whole empire of YouTube shows that they make. And that brings sort of what I'm trying to do to an audience which is completely different from who would read the New York Times or, you know, who might read something I read in JAMA or something I'd write in the peer-reviewed literature. So I'm thankful, but I'm also really interested in all of these different media because they allow us to reach different audiences with trying to get the same message across.
Your writing partner, Austin Fracht, the two of you were the Incidental Economist for years and have brought in other authors along the way. He was on this podcast a while ago. We talked about his communication across different forums. Do you feel like there's more responsibility when you are writing in the pages of the Times as opposed to, say, blogging on your own site?
I mean, certainly responsibility in the sense that if I make a mistake on the blog, it's really easy for me to say mea culpa, fix it, and own it. I do get worried more that if I make a mistake in the New York Times, that's their reputation. And so I wouldn't say I'm more careful, but I do get a little more panicked because it's very easy for me to just put a correction and fix something on the blog and say, hey, I did this. What are you going to do? At the New York Times, there's much more concern. I would say that causes me to be a bit more careful and thorough with the New York Times. I mean, when I'm doing a literature review to write a piece in the New York Times, I'm pretty thorough. I wouldn't say it's up to the level of a systematic review, but I really try to make sure I'm not missing anything. And everything is very heavily cited and linked, and they do reasonable amount of fact-checking. And so I would say that there's more perhaps weight, but I wouldn't say that I care more or that I try harder with respect to the Times than anywhere else.
Your most recent piece in the Times was on the contraception mandate or the attempt by HHS to roll it back. It is fairly hard on HHS. These are analyses that are informed by some opinion, I think it's fair to say.
Absolutely.
Do you feel like your role is to provide a supplement to the daily news in the Times? Is it to be some mix of op-ed and reporting?
So I'm definitely not news in the sense that I don't almost ever do original reporting or, you know, try to investigate or determine anything. I feel like my contribution is that I'm trying to bring data and evidence from, you know, the public sphere, the medical literature or other data sources, and use that to craft an argument where you don't just see why I'm saying something, but also I'm very transparent about how I got there. That if you disagree, so be it. With respect to the contraception mandate, it was an attempt to say they're saying X, Y, and Z by making these three citations. I want to bring things to a broader context and say that's really cherry picking, that if we look holistically at all the data and evidence that are out there, the conclusions probably would be different. What I like doing about it in public is if people disagree, then I encourage them to craft their own arguments. I mean, I'm more than happy to be proven wrong. There's opinion, I think, in what I write in the sense that at the end of the day, I'm saying I have a worldview or something to say based upon these data and evidence, but I'm very careful about the latter, that those have to exist. I'm not really writing an opinion column where I'm saying, hey, I just have an idea and this is what I think. It's really based on research or publicly available data sources.
You recently wrote or at least tweeted about Medicare for All, the provision that's gotten a lot of traction among progressives on the left. You threw some cold water on the idea. Can you talk a little bit about your thoughts on the Medicare for All concept based on what you've researched?
Yeah. So I believe that, you know, Medicare for All is a viable solution by which we could achieve universal health care. But I also believe that everything has trade-offs and that, you know, attempts to achieve greater access are likely going to come at greater cost or with some degradation of quality or access in some other way we might measure. And my biggest problem, I think, with some advocates for people who support Medicare for All, and I have this same issue with advocates on the right, so this is a, you know, both sides, even though I hate that kind of thing, is that I don't think that a lot of them are being truly honest about what the trade-offs would be. For instance, if we just had Medicare for All as Medicare, it's a lot less thorough than many employer-sponsored health programs. And so a lot of people who have employer-sponsored health care would not be happy with Medicare. We should acknowledge that. And if we're going to transition everyone off of their employer-sponsored health care, that will not be seen positively by everyone. Now, if you're saying, no, instead we're not going to give everyone Medicare, we're going to give them something even better, well, that's likely to be more expensive. How are you going to do that? How are you going to you can't create networks at that point. How will we keep costs down without just reducing reimbursement? And if your goal is to reduce reimbursement on the entire healthcare system, prepare for the mother of all battles as they fight back. So, and of course, how do we fund it? You know, if we're going to talk about transitioning people away from health insurance premiums into a broader tax, that's fine. But when you say those words out loud, there's going to be rebellion. And so I just want people to be clear that there is no free lunch, that, you know, you can't just have universal healthcare. Although I would say this was part of our impetus for doing the battle of the healthcare systems in the Times, is because there seems to be this sense sometimes in the United States that our two choices are what we've got and socialism, and that there's no other room in between. It's this or even more capitalism or single-payer healthcare. And that's not, when people say the rest of the world has single payer, that's not true. The rest of the world pretty much has universal health care, but they do it by many different means. And not all of them, in fact, I think the minority are single payer health care. A lot of them are through tightly regulated private markets. And that's another solution by which we could get to universal health care.
Hey, it's Dan Diamond, and we'll get back to the conversation with Aaron in a moment. But first, a word from our sponsor.
A message from the John A. Hartford Foundation. Healthcare for older adults in America needs to change. Poor quality healthcare harms older patients, causes families to suffer, and waste money. The John A. Hartford Foundation believes that older adults should receive high-value, evidence-based healthcare that treats people with respect and dignity and meets their goals and preferences. For more than 35 years, the John A. Hartford Foundation has built a field of experts in aging and health and has committed to making more than 1,000 U.S. hospitals age-friendly by 2020. The John A. Hartford Foundation and its subject matter experts are a nonpartisan resource for developing policy around cost-effective, value-based, age-friendly health systems, providing the tools you need to improve the care of older adults. Learn more at johnahartford.org.
I think it's fair to say that much of your writing comes down in a progressive space in terms of thinking about the value of coverage expansion, criticism of this administration. When writing about Medicare for All in such a ideally objective way, did you get pushback?
Oh my gosh, yes.
From your normal?
Oh my gosh, yes. I could have predicted ahead of time the emails I would have been getting, and I got all of them and more. And some were very angry at me from people I know quite well. And certainly people I've worked with in the past when I think I probably was more optimistic about single-payer healthcare in the United States. I got a lot of pushback on Twitter. I got plenty of nasty emails. But it's not the first time that's happened. Even when the Affordable Care Act was being passed, at times I was writing many pieces in the blog and elsewhere being critical about the process, but also acknowledging that it's not as if we could snap our fingers and achieve single-payer healthcare instead. And when I was willing to make compromises, again, I got attacked from the left pretty heavily.
One interesting thing about you and your work is, as you mentioned, you're based in Indiana. I mean, D.C., we have a glut of healthcare reporters and policy types. Your partner, Austin, up in Boston, not exactly short on people who are available to weigh in on healthcare there, too. But you get to see on the ground the impact of Governor Mike Pence.
Yeah.
And his healthy Indiana and Seema Verma, right?
The whole architecture came from there.
We have imported the Pence team into HHS and the Washington, D.C. Policy environment. How successful was the Healthy Indiana plan, asking someone who's on the ground still seeing patients in Indiana?
So we would love to have a better analysis of what HIP and HIP 2.0 have done. And unfortunately, the analyses that have been done are not great. But first of all, I would say it does provide me with a great perspective to live in a red state. I mean, to see a different way of thinking has definitely made my writing better. And my understanding, I think, about healthcare policy is
what's one example of that?
So I will say I have friends who voted for President Trump, which is not something I run across all the time when I talk about health policy experts. I would also say that we've learned to live with HIP and HIP 2.0, that I would rather have the Healthy Indiana plan than no Medicaid expansion. To give everyone a flavor if they don't know what HIP and HIP 2.0 are, our Medicaid expansion was done through the use of basically health savings accounts and consumer-directed health care, and requiring people who would otherwise not have to pay a premium, people above the poverty line, to pay a small premium. Now, I've written about it in the New York Times that I don't think this is a good idea, that it actually drives people away from insurance, it limits it. However, I'm willing to take that above no Medicaid expansion. And I would say that our Medicaid expansion and HIP 2.0 have done good. I do not think that improvement is because of the power accounts or the health savings accounts, or the things that Governor, now Vice President Pence would say, or Seema Verma might say. But we've definitely seen that the increased coverage and the other ways that we do and the things that we find to close the gaps definitely have probably improved coverage and improved health. And so I'd rather have that than not. I think it's also made me more willing to compromise and to accept that I'm not going to get everything that I want. I'll be honest, as soon as the election occurred, I remember Mo and Austin and I had a conversation. We were like, well, maybe this will be good. We will see some conservative implemented healthcare ideas. We'll get a chance to do studies like the Oregon Medicaid experiment, but for the conservative side, to see how these plans go into place. I don't think any of us predicted how badly, sort of the chances for repeal, replace, or maybe some people predicted that, but how badly this might go. But I was optimistic that maybe we would see some conservative ideas enacted and we get a chance to study them and see what worked and what doesn't. Unfortunately, I don't think that's really happened. I don't think we're going to have a great chance to see that. But it is a chance. And I think it's, I think in general, when I think about what being in Indiana has helped as well, it just has exposed me to different people's philosophies.
Georgetown's Joan Alker was on this podcast talking about how the Healthy Indiana plan has locked out some otherwise deserving residents who weren't able to pay the premium up front, or had other problems accommodating to that system?
Well, I'm not here to say that the Healthy Indiana Plan is a major success and, like, you know, this is the way that we should do Medicaid expansion. I just live in a world where the options on the table were that or nothing. And I will take that. This is what the kind of thing I think that gets me into trouble with some of my single payer.
I feel like
friends.
There's a metaphor, like a glass half full or half empty.
Well, it's the something. Enemy of the perfect, you know, making the perfect the enemy of the good, that kind of thing. I'm willing to take HIP 2.0 as a, you know, because the other option on the table was nothing. But I'm okay with risk reduction. I'm okay with the idea that I'd rather have, I mean, I'm a pediatrician. I'd rather have parents smoke outside than smoke inside with their children. I'd rather they quit, but I will take smoking outside above smoking inside with their children. There's many ways. I will talk about sex education. You know, there are always gradations of risk and everything else. And I would always go for risk and harm reduction as opposed to doing nothing at all. And in this case, I think HIP 2.0 is the same thing. It's better than nothing.
As a pediatrician, how worried are you about the stall on renewing children's health insurance program funding? It's a story that hasn't gotten perhaps as much attention as it normally would. There's an assumption in Washington, D.C. that they will hammer something out and that states are essentially going to be okay at the end of the day.
I'm pretty upset about this, but I keep getting told what you just said, that that yes, they let it lapse, but this is something that has bipartisan support and it's going to get folded into some big package in December and everything is going to be fine. I've panicked about this enough times and seen it resolved that I'm just trying to remain calm. This is like a doc fix thing to me. It's like it goes over and over and we do the dance again and again and again. I don't understand why we run healthcare this way in the United States, where it has to keep running out every 6 to 12 months and we have to keep panicking about it. But we've done this enough times that I think that they will pass it and keep the program going.
What's the best policy idea that you've studied or written about that you think needs to be adopted on a large scale?
Well, this is when I will say something that will make me thoroughly unelectable forever. I'm fine with us deciding not to pay for things that don't work, whether we call that value-based insurance, whether we call that reference pricing.
Could we call that rationing?
Well, some people absolutely will. And rationing, unfortunately, is a four-letter word. But I have no problem rationing things that don't work. It's just not a problem for me. That's why I'll never be elected to office in the United States.
Well, you won't get any donations from the health care industry.
Well, it depends which ones I'm denying. But there's, I mean, I've written about this column after column about surgical procedures that don't work when we put them up for placebo-controlled trials, for medications that don't work when we, you know, really look into them, even for policies that don't appear to work, and yet we keep doing them again and again and again. We have a hard time stopping things and saying no. I think cutting out things that don't work is the best way for us to move forward in the short term, because it's the only way I can imagine where we decrease spending without decreasing quality. Basically, like we're maximizing value. Anything else we cut is, you know, we can debate about the cost effectiveness, or, you know, should we charge people more for this? But there's plenty of stuff on the table that doesn't work, and we could stop that immediately.
You've emerged as the preeminent mythbuster in healthcare, of your generation at least. I think we can bound it a bit. But you write about myths about crossing your eyes and, yep, and the gum that you swallow. Your most recent book, or the book that's coming very soon, The Bad Food Bible, mm-hmm, is about the foods that we could or should be eating or not eating.
And this grew right out of many of the columns I've written or many of the videos I've done looking at nutrition in the last few years, which ironically enough have been some of the most popular that I've certainly written at the times or videos that we've done. I'm amazed, the more I've looked into it, how badly we've bunged nutrition science and how little we truly know about what is dangerous for us and what is healthy for us. But I've been especially shocked in the last few years, and as I've written about fat or meat or salt, or, you know, our sort of peanuts, how many times we've identified food and we said, these are things that are terrible for us, we must avoid them. And then when the better studies get done, it turns out we're completely wrong. Sometimes, I mean, even 180 degrees, forget that we didn't get it wrong about those things being dangerous. Sometimes they're actually good for us. And so The book came out of the idea that there's a lot of foods which are demonized, which we're told are truly bad for our health and that we should avoid, where the science is bad or unequivocal or sometimes even pointing in the opposite direction. And that's what the book is about.
I have selfish interest in learning more here because I got a review from my primary care physician very recently, and for the first time in my life was told that I need to change my diet.
Why?
Well, despite the exterior, apparently my cholesterol is a little high. My good cholesterol has always been high, but my bad cholesterol is now a little high.
So how did they tell you to change your diet to lower your cholesterol?
Switch to a low-fat diet.
First of all, what amazes me is—
It sounds like you should be my doctor, so I'll continue to keep eating burgers every night and feel okay about it.
So first of all, it is good at least that your doctor didn't tell you to lower your dietary cholesterol, because that's what we used to tell everybody. And now, I mean, in the last issue of the USDA guidelines, they actually said cholesterol is no longer a nutrient of concern. Like, the idea that you needed to avoid eggs or avoid shrimp because it's bad for your cholesterol, completely disproven by randomized controlled trials. And yet I was raised on egg white omelets and no butter, but egg white omelets and, you know, avoiding other foods as well. And it makes no sense, and there's no science for it. With respect to low fat, there's some evidence on saturated fat. That perhaps, and even then, the link is not nearly as strong for everyone as it appears to be. But when people just say low fat, what they wind up doing is actually eliminating all fat. And even again, the USDA guidelines have changed to say, you know, we shouldn't be limiting our unsaturated fat. Maybe we should be limiting our saturated fat. But the idea that you just need to go to a low fat diet, well, if we go to a low fat diet, what are you going to replace it with? Carbs, which again have been proven to be terrible in so many different ways. You can only eat basically protein, carbs, or fat. I mean, there's only nutrients in so many ways. And so continuing to point at one and say, reduce this, and especially if you go anti-meat and say no fat and no meat, well, now you're left with carbs, unless you're eating a massively protein-based vegetable diet, which very few people do. So I think more moderation is the way to go. I'd also say truly, we could talk about this online, but if your cholesterol is high, it's very likely that either you know, one of the medications might do better, or that you have to just view cholesterol as one of the many things which are related to heart health. And that if everything else is great, then the cholesterol probably has very little impact on your overall risk of having a heart attack or another cardiovascular outcome.
Well, maybe I shouldn't say this as a healthcare reporter. I hate the idea of taking medication for anything.
Fair.
And I really want to stay away from the possibility of using statins.
Right.
So swapping out my morning bagel, which often was my morning bagel with steak and eggs.
Right.
I can't imagine why my cholesterol might be high. Swapping that out for some fruit and granola, I'm miserable, but at the same time, it feels like a better intervention.
Maybe. I would be curious to see if your cholesterol really changes. And that's where I'd say, like, make your N of one trial. Really follow up and have it checked and see if it really made a difference. The truth of the matter is that for otherwise healthy people, especially if you're reasonably young, you know, your chance of bad cardiovascular outcomes are very low, especially unless you have a really bad family history or some, you know, you're smoking or doing something else. And so, you know, depending upon your cholesterol has to get pretty high before your impact gets really high, in which case my cholesterol is moderately high. We just monitor it, because what else are you going to do? Because, again, my cholesterol is high, but my good cholesterol is high and my bad cholesterol is high. So is it the ratio? Is everything else? It's never quite as clear as people think.
This actually plays into a question I've had for you. Maybe it can be our last focus, which is the sharing of personal information when you write about healthcare. And you've done this throughout the years. You've talked about your medical history, your family background. Your dad is a doctor. I read that in one of your columns and how that influenced your approach. Do you feel like that changes the way that you're able to tell these stories in a positive way, or does it at times take away from the clinical objectivity of talking about an issue?
It's one of the things I've had to learn to do as a writer, because the scientist in me loathes the anecdote. And in fact, I have tried at the beginning of my career to avoid it completely.
We're told constantly in the reporting world, take yourself out of it. It's not about the reporter, it's about the issue.
And yet, when I tell stories, it brings people in. And it's easiest sometimes to tell the stories, and I think it affects readers the most when I tell stories about myself. And so writing about the difficulties I've had with the healthcare system because of how hard it is to get my ulcerative colitis medication, I got more emails about that than almost anything else I've ever written.
That was a pretty bleak story. Every 3 months you had to prescription.
And it's still going on. I mean, I tweet out regularly my day of anger when I have to go get my labs and try to figure out how this whole thing works.
This was a two-year-old story in the Upshot, if memory serves, about your experience with the healthcare system. It's absolutely worth reading.
It's still going on. And if, you know, there are times I wrote about doctors and depression and again brought up mental health issues, I think, that I have had in the past. And I've gotten a ton of feedback about that as well, especially from doctors who are afraid to talk about those issues. So certainly I think it's important, and I think it's made a difference, and I would continue to do it. So when I can use my own personal history as a means to broaden our discussion and show that these things actually happen, that's what I like to use. I don't still like to tell individual stories and say, that's how you should, you know, that's why the healthcare system is so bad, or that's why you should learn a lesson. I'd still much rather do that with data and research.
Okay. Well, we will look forward to reading your pieces that combine data and research and occasionally personal input in the upshot, and your new book, The Bad Food Bible.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Dr. Erin Carroll. That's it for Pulse Check this week. Thanks to Erin Carroll for joining us in D.C. and Bridget for joining us as always. You can find Pulse Check on all your favorite podcast apps. You can find me at ddiamond@politico.com. And you can find a new episode of Pulse Check in your podcast player next week.